The five biggest stories.
I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story.
Five opinions.
Blah, blah, blah. Yada, yada, yada.
Each and every week.
That would be great.
This is the Intersection Podcast with Jason Page.
Fantastic.
Here's Jason.
Thank you, Chad Erickson. Good to be with you. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Intersection Podcast. My guest inside the intersection this week is Lon McCarron. Alongside Norman Chad, he's called the action at the World Series of Poker on ESPN for 17 years. But he's been around the sportscasting world for a lot longer than that. In our conversation, we got into the world of poker, going back over those 17 years and looking at where it is now. I also asked Lon to tell me the one event he would still like to call. He'll get his answer. But I began our conversation with a story I've never told before. It tells a bit about how Lon and I became introduced to one another. I want to start in a way that is not going to portray me in the best light. A lot of people might be asking, how do you know Lon McCarron? How did you get to talk to him? How did you get him on the podcast, on the show, all this stuff? Here's the actual story of how I met Lon McCarron. So I obviously watched Lon for years on the World Series of Poker coverage, going back to 2003, the Chris Moneymaker, and we'll get into all the poker stuff. But the way I got to know Lon was this. I think it was 2012 or 2013. I was kind of in between broadcasting gigs. I was leaving San Francisco for the first time. I went back to the East Coast where I was getting ready to go work for ESPN Radio in New York City. And at the time, I'm a huge bowler. Huge bowler. I mean, I've been bowling since I was nine. Bowled really well throughout much of my life, was averaged over 200 and bowled a lot of tournaments and things like that. And I noticed that the PBA Tour, I had done play-by-play in my career, minor league baseball, college football, pro football, and I noticed the PBA Tour was advertising they had a job opening for a play-by-play guy or a play-by-play person to work with Randy Peterson. So I got in touch with Tom Clark over at the PBA Tour. I'm like, Tom, this is right up my alley. I didn't have an agent at the time. I was kind of in between agents, so I decided to work it myself. And Tom was like, well, we kind of already got somebody in mind. And I'm like, come on, man. I'm like, give me a shot. But it was already kind of deep into the process. And I said, who you got in mind? He goes, well, we're talking to this guy, Lon McCarron. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Lon McCarron to do bowling? He's the poker guy. Like, come on. X Games, Lon McCarron. No, come on, man. And he's like, yeah, no, that's probably who we're going with. And I was like, damn it, man. This job was right up my alley. I was pissed at Tom. I didn't talk to him for a while. And we've made up now, but I was kind of pissed. And then I started watching Lon doing the bowling broadcasts. And there's no better way to say it. I was a dick. I was a real dick. So Lon is doing the play-by-play, and it was like the first broadcast, and I'm on Twitter doing my usual trolling thing. And Lon's doing a broadcast, and he says something during the broadcast. I can't remember what it was. But I immediately took to Twitter, and I heckled him. I did the heckle job on Twitter of Lon. It was like his first broadcast. I'm just being a jerk because I'm bitter because I couldn't get the job. And Lon, to his credit, because he's a far better human being than I will ever be, Lon shoots me back a kind of a fun response. Not like, hey, go F yourself. He took it totally in stride. Was like, hey, maybe you can, give me some pointers. And from that moment on, I was completely smitten with Lon McCarron. It was a love fest. Love the guy. No, really, because not too many people would take kindly to getting criticized on Twitter by some, half-baked broadcaster like me. But you took it all in stride, and it was fun, and you did the PBA Tour for that 1 year.
And we met in New York, remember? We met at a bar in New York to talk this all out. Yeah.
And that's what happened. Lon wound up coming, and Lon one day was like, hey, when I come to New York, we'll meet up. And that's when we actually sat down and talked. And you said something to me when we first sat down and talked. I don't remember, but it was something to the effect of, man, why were you such a dick? Which frankly, I deserved. But talk about, just for a second, because I want to go a little bit through your career, not just the poker stuff, but through your career. How did the bowling thing come about? And what did you make of winding up doing that for a year?
God, that was a horrendous experience getting it.
Why was it a horrendous experience?
All right, so I'll tell you, the backstory for me. I did not know that you had gone through and you knew Tom that well and all. But so I got the job, and it was a time early still-ish in poker, I think. You know, I mean, they'd been through some good years, but freelancers are always looking for another gig, right? And it was going to be okay money for a freelance thing and for what I was doing. And so I got the gig, and I might be misremembering, but the big picture is that then they said, no, you don't have it anymore. And it's like, oh, I remember in a hotel room with my wife at the time. And it's like, we were planning on this. And then they yanked it out from under me. And they said, we're going with Gary Thorne.
Oh, Gary Thorne of the famous Pete Weber call. Who do you think you are?
I was a big Gary Thorne fan. I loved his hockey. You know, I'd worked with him when I was doing, some stuff with Monday Night Baseball at the time and all that. But I was bitterly disappointed. And then they call me back, and suddenly I feel like sloppy seconds because they call me back and says, oh, Gary wanted too much money. And so then they gave it back to me.
It was like a backhanded compliment. Well, we could get you cheaper, so we'll get you. That's that, by the way.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying this to disparage Tom Clark and the PBA Tour, but that is a very PBA Tourish kind of story.
Yeah. Well, what I learned, okay, so my 1 year, and, you know, my first year in poker was you know, and I learned, and I know I didn't have all the terminology, and I didn't have all the nuance that people wanted. I mean, I was so honored to be on this show. I watched it growing up. It was a thing, and to be included on that list of announcers doing PBA on an ABC / ESPN, it was such an honor. It was a feather in my cap, and I really wanted to make something happen. And I loved Randy. When I worked in local television in California in Santa Maria, he was from Santa Maria. I didn't know him. He won his first tournament. I had him on my show at local TV in Santa Maria, California, market number 116, like two or three times. And back when he won his first tournament, second tournament, and then we never saw each other until the day I walked in after getting the job. And I wish I could have gone on further with it, because I think it could have been, you know, something really special, and he would have taught me and I would have learned. But then talk about a PBA thing, and I'm not going to dish on the people who are there because, you know, but the guy's gone now. So the guy who had taken over, he made a budget near the end of the first year. He created a budget and then left to go work for Twitter. And then I get a call saying, this budget we have does not include a play-by-play announcer.
Yes.
There's no money in the budget for a play-by-play announcer.
I remember them saying that.
And they took the sideline live PA guy who knew bowling and all the, you know, upside down and backwards. And so
your intel matches mine.
And so I'm a little bitter because I think I could have been a lot better, and it wasn't my, you know, finest moment.
Your intel matches mine too, because they told me that they basically had no money in the budget. They were just going to take the guy who does
literally
like the web
no line item for play by play.
And they were like, we're just going to take the guy who does the web streaming during the week for Full Frame, I think it's called, or 10th Frame, whatever their web streaming thing is. And we're going to put him on. And again, I like Tom Clark. I think it's an admirable job what he's been able to do to get the PBA Tour back to life on TV with Fox.
And this was not his call at the time. Either.
Right.
That was not Tom's call at the time.
So no, I give him a lot of credit for that, but I'll always kind of harbor a bit of a grudge because you got the job that would have been my dream job as somebody that's literally been bowling since he was 9 years old. Talking about Lon McCarron here on the Intersection podcast, and really a treat for me because he's somebody that frankly, doesn't need to come on with me.
hey, I haven't worked in a year and a half. No, I did work last weekend. I did the World Series last week. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, no, so you're in the middle of doing the World Series, and I want to kind of rewind a little bit because I'm not, you know, this is your life sort of thing, but, you know, I go back to 2003, and it's hard to believe it's been, you know, almost 18 years now that we're talking about, you know, the moneymaker effect and all that. And what made me actually think of you was I saw the story about Chris Moneymaker leaving, I think it was Poker Stars, after being with them for so long and being let go. And I know he's been picked up by another company now, but talk about, is it possible to overstate the moneymaker effect? I mean, do we sometimes go too far, or was his impact and what he did in 2003, basically going from nobody to World Series of Poker winner, is it possible to overstate his impact on the game?
From my perspective, no, because I'm so emotionally involved and have made so many mortgage payments because of him. But I will say that it was a confluence. It was a perfect storm. You know, we had ESPN committed. They had been airing stuff, but it wasn't, you know, great stuff. And so you had Moneymaker. You had ESPN in the first year of what has now been their long standing run. You had the whole camera. You could see all the cards of the players. And you had millions of dollars at play. And you had a great, you know, foil in Sami Farha in second place. So that all combined to really light the fuse. What kept the bomb blowing up, though, was Chris Moneymaker because of who he is. He, I can't believe he's lasted this long with PokerStars because they put him on the road. He has been on the road until like a month ago from 2004. And he had done so much for them and so much for the fans and for the small poker rooms who invited him in. And he said yes, and he came down. He would sit for a week in a small poker room and play on their live stream if they had one, or their tournaments or cash games, hang out and drink with them. And just so he's the one that really kept that ball rolling after the initial explosion. So I give him all the credit in the world. Absolutely.
Do other people in the poker world disagree with the sentiment that you know, he's responsible for the big boom?
No.
Because you made it sound like you, from your perspective, do. But are there other people who are almost bitter towards the fact that he's gotten so much attention or so much credit for it?
No, because he is, I would compare him to Tiger Woods and
wow,
how he brought attention to golf. He brought sponsors to golf. He bought money to golf. And that's exactly what Moneymaker did. Nobody was complaining, you know, about $1 million poker purse in Houston this last week. You know, it would not have happened in the long run without Chris and what he did, you know, after winning the main event. So, no, everyone, they see Chris and, you know, there's a little bow down to Moneymaker wherever you go.
You talk about the Tiger comparison with Moneymaker. I want to make a comparison, and probably others have made this comparison. I try not to read too much what other people say and do, because then I feel sometimes it impacts my own thoughts, and I like to kind of have my own original thoughts.
Then you might figure out you're wrong. You don't want to do that.
Exactly. But I think of you and Norm and Chad, and I'm sure people have had to have said this to you. You're the Madden and Summerall of poker. I mean, you guys are the Madden and Summerall. You are the John Madden and Pat Summerall of the poker world in terms of your longevity, your banter back and forth, the relationship on the air, at least. Give me some sense for what this last, you know, 18 years, and I know it's been a blur probably for you, and I know Norman's recovering from COVID, so get well wishes to Norman, who I think I last interviewed about 11 years ago when I was in Hartford. Talk about that relationship and what that has meant in the overall scheme of this broadcast team.
In a sense, we hit the ground running from my point of view. Norman didn't know who I was, but I knew who Norman was. I read his weekly column in the San Jose Mercury News every Friday, NFL picks, and I would just laugh out loud. I loved his sense of humor. I appreciated what he was doing, and I knew exactly what he was doing. And he was bringing seriousness with an overtone of you know, comedy. And that carried through into the poker shows and even in our personal relationship, because, you know, I talked to him on the phone all through those 17 years. And people think I do a fake laugh pretty good, but it's not. I think he's hilarious. And he would call my house, and my wife knew who I was talking to. And it was just laughter at all times. So, very smart. He knows the game. He has a non-jaded sensibility about sports, anything he's doing. but I respect him so much and his journalistic integrity. And our main producer just a few days ago, Matt Morantz from 441 Production, the original company that did the poker shows, tweeted out, he says, now that Norman can't do these shows, it's a good time to really laud what he has done. And he more than anyone knows what Norman did for the early years. He was the backbone of those shows on a journalistic level, on a comedic level, on a just a general sensibility in how we're going to treat poker. So, again, I people don't understand really how much Norman meant to the TV shows. They just heard his one-liners. But so much behind the scenes is coming from him. It's amazing.
What's the relationship like between you two and the players? You know, if you go walking through the rooms, what is that relationship like? Is there that reverence for you, for him? Is there an appreciation? Do you get the sense that players understand what you two have meant as much to the broadcasts as their play has?
In a general way, yes. Specifically, also there are players who don't like our style because it's not poker. You know, they don't think it's not as much poker. It's more, you know, it's meant for the ESPN audience.
It's entertainment,
exactly. So, they do appreciate it on the whole. I will say that you know, for years, we really could not walk around the Rio during the World Series of Poker together. We had to just go on opposite directions and move our way through the room. We wouldn't get any work done. And it was very gratifying. And that all came to a head this year when we were nominated for the Poker Hall of Fame. And so that meant a lot. And that's the kind of thing we've been feeling for a long time, is this sense that we had something to do with the poker boom as well. And we were along for the ride. I remember the first couple of shows, we looked at them before we actually were working and announcing on them, and we thought they were just amazing shows. And Norman and I looked at each other and says, let's not screw this up. That was our goal, not to screw up what the producers gave us. And our goal was just to make it a little better. You could have run it without any announcers. Glad they didn't. But hopefully we made it a little better each time.
Our conversation with Lon McCarron of the World Series of Poker, a longtime broadcaster in the sports industry, a local broadcaster in the Bay Area, has had a really great run throughout his career. And he was somebody I really wanted to talk to when we were planning this season of the Intersection podcast. He was actually one of the first people I reached out to while I was in quarantine for 2 weeks in a hotel room in Singapore. After Moneymaker, who's been the most important poker player in the last 20 years? Who's been the most influential, impactful poker player in the last 20 years?
There are three different levels on that. Overall, I'm probably going to think Phil Hellmuth.
I had a feeling he would be in the list.
Yeah, you know, but there is a list. You know, it's hard because there's something for everyone. There,
Daniel Negreanu.
The hardcore folks is Phil Ivey, probably the best player ever. There's the Doyle Brunson, who brings the old leather ass, high rollers story, and just like in awe of this guy. And then, of course, a Daniel Negreanu, who is just omnipresent. And so you put those four together, and I think you do a pretty good job of the best of everything in the last 20 years.
Lon, when you think about where the game is now, where it was in 2003 versus now, and we talk about the different innovations and online poker, and you know, poker was everywhere at one point. I remember I used to walk into Mohegan Sun on a Saturday night, and I couldn't even get on a table. I'd just sit there and wait and wait and wait. What has been the biggest innovation per se that has sort of catapulted the game?
Computers. And it started with the online play.
Party poker.
And party poker, poker stars, full tilt poker. And then a few bad actors here and there. But that got people to the World Series. They would play, in the poker terminology, they'd play satellites. And so for a $10,000 buy-in to the main event, you were able to go through a process. If you wanted to start with a $1 buy-in, win that tournament, go to a $100 buy-in, go to a 5K, you know, so you make the steps. So you had almost maybe 50% of the field coming in with these satellites, online satellites. So that's one, because you had the monster fields. Two, online poker, because then the technology started evolving where you could track what other players are doing. You could know who your opponents are, not just an anonymous screen name across the way. You could track what they've done, who they've played, how they play, the hands they played. And then that became, that evolved into a training sense where you could, there's so many training modes online now. And then that's a paid business now. And you've got all these training sites. And then you've got the solvers that tell you, this computer program that tell you the optimal way to play a hand. And and I use the word solvers, that's what it's called. But people are worried that no limit hold'em is going to be solved, like chess and backgammon,
right,
things like that, where it can be so predictable.
Is it almost analysis? Paralysis by analysis, though? You know, I mean, as somebody who watches the game and observes it and sits with Norman, and you guys probably talk about this back and forth, is there something to be said for sometimes getting too inside the numbers? You know, we talk about it in baseball all the time. Oh, it's become so statistics oriented and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Is it sometimes just I have always been a feel player. I have always played based on feel, who I'm sitting with at a table, kind of letting a couple of rounds go around and analyzing who my competition is and getting a sense for who the better players at the table are and kind of zeroing in on, you know, certain marks, so to speak, at the table. I mean, is there something to be said for just old-fashioned just sitting down and playing poker?
Yeah, there is. And it's mostly in your local, you know, card room that you're going to play in with people that you see a lot and the people that are going to be regulars there. Where the training comes in is such a small percentage of the players. You're going to see it at a main event, a 10,000 player main event. You know, it is the 1%, 1% of the 1% maybe. So this whole training kick, I'll say, as it were, is for those elite players. And then they've got kind of like a separate tour. They had a high roller tour and they just go around the world and trade money, basically. You know, you had a small group of people and hopefully to get a rich businessman who thinks he can play with them. So that's where all that comes in. And it comes down to odds, and they train themselves to play the odds. And in the long run, and that's the thing, great poker players don't go to the card room and come home and say, hey, I won $1,000 tonight. You know, that's a minuscule thing, you know, and you've heard this too, where you've got to look at it as a year-long session and keep records. And if you lose one night, you go back, you're going to win another night. So it's all about the numbers and all about the odds. When you get to the main event, which is what we broadcast on ESPN, it's great because you get those players, but they're having to deal with these, no pun intended, these wild card players from nowhere who are field players who are making it their life goal to play in the main event. And so they're unpredictable. And then you've got an unpredictable deck. And those meet, and you have some guy you never heard of winning the main event. So it's fun that way. But that whole training thing is that upper echelon. They play high roller online, high roller live, and that's where that all comes in. And they level each other. It's like they know what the other guy's going to do, so that guy knows what he knows he's going to do, and I know what you know that I know. So it's crazy. It is. Not for the normal poker player.
You and I both play the game. You probably play it now definitely more than I do, because in Singapore, the limits are a lot higher. Like, I don't even think there is such a thing as 1-2 here. Like, it starts at a higher limit, like the very starting. And there's only a couple of major casinos here where you can play. But I used to play a lot. I mean, my first go-around living in New York City, I used to play 3 or 4 days a week in the underground games. That's where I cut my teeth, learned how to play, got my ass kicked, lost a ton of money. Wound up losing the person that was supposed to be my first spouse. I mean, just the horror stories that you hear about. You know, it's like it's the rounders thing with Matt Damon, where he's like, you never hear about the people that lose; you only hear about the people that win. And so, I cut my teeth playing in the underground. I didn't play in casinos. I was playing in literally those games where you knock on a door, somebody slides open a thing, and they're usually got a gun strapped to their waist. I mean, it was literally that.
Yeah,
and that's kind of where I cut my teeth and learned how to play, because poker wasn't legal in New York City. As I grew in the broadcasting industry and people started to know who I was, if I'd go into a casino or into a card room, people knew who I was, and there was automatically a target on my back. While people would smile and say, "Hey, it's Jason Page from 95.7 The Game," or "Hey, it's Jason Page from ESPN New York," or you know, I see him on TV, whatever. They were coming to take my money because they wanted to be the one that took the guy's money at the table who's the sportscaster. You have to go through the same thing, probably to the nth degree, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Is it difficult for you to even play poker? Because I have to imagine every time you walk into a room, there's some hotshot who's like, I want to be the one to bust Lon McCarron.
They will declare that once they figure out who I am. And a lot of times they don't know who I am until I say something. And then they recognize a voice, and then it bubbles around the table. And that's fine. I am not a serious enough player where that's going to get in my way of doing what I want to do. And actually, I bring it on myself, too, because there's a local card room in the Sacramento area in California that I have been employed by. So I'm their poker ambassador. My job is to go in there and get knocked out or give them an experience and play their hand and play a hand with them. So, it is tough. And it does change when I'm playing an actual larger tournament because the people there, they know who I am. They're not wowed by who I am or they're not saying it, you know, verbally. But they still have I can tell. You know, I get a lot of action when I'm in a hand. There's a lot of people who want to get in there. And if you play right, you can use that to your advantage, too, because they're going to play extra hands against you, which means that the hands they're playing aren't as premium. And
yes.
You get a good hand, you know, you play against them. So, you know, I consider myself not a poker player. I'm an ambassador for the game by default.
But you're good. Just you're being modest. You're good. You know how to play the game.
You know, I've had
you
some
can't
success
watch and, for 17 years and not get
oh,
good.
Oh, can't help it rub off. Right. So it depends the setting I'm in. If I'm going to play a World Series event or a World Series circuit event, I know those players, you know, it's a higher buy-in and I know their skill and I'm very careful and I'm much better player when I'm careful. If I'm playing with my buds in the local room where I'm hired, you know, I'm a lot looser and, but still, I walk away pissed when I get knocked out. I still have that competitive edge, but I have that Scottish streak in me and my DNA, which just hates losing money too or spending money. So it's a tough world to be in if you're a tight player. It really is.
Yeah, I could imagine talking with Lon McCarron on the Intersection podcast. Gambling at large, because look, there are some people who will look at poker and say, "Well, it's gambling." And I am somebody who has talked very openly about my gambling addiction over the last 20 plus years. And a lot of people say, well, poker's not gambling because it's a game of skill. And most states now have ruled it a game of skill, which is why it's allowed in so many places. And that's, you know, part of the lure of it is that it's more of a game of skill. Yes, there is the element of chance. You don't know which cards are going to get flipped over as much math as you do in your head. There's still odds to be worked out and all of that. But gambling at large, you get to be around it a lot when you go cover the World Series of Poker. How much has gambling at large sort of changed and evolved? Because now you've got casinos everywhere. You've got online gambling available everywhere. Online poker being played everywhere. It's a zillion-dollar industry. There's so much money being made on gambling. And I can't help but ask this question because I think about it a lot, and I don't want to sound like the Debbie Downer on this. But are we, on some level as a society in the United States, capitalizing on people that have addictions and have these predilections and have these issues with gambling? Are we almost preying on them at this point with the ease with which we have made it to gamble and be involved in the gambling world?
Yes, absolutely. And it can be seen in the Native American casinos that can pop up just about anywhere.
Yes.
You can see it at the Venetian in Las Vegas, where the late Sheldon Adelson so despised online poker on one hand, even though it could help his business, and just thought it was so dangerous and so terrible. And on the other hand, you know, he's doing the exact same thing in his casino, and there are underage gamblers in his casino as well. So, yes, that almighty buck, you know, and it is too easy to do it. I totally agree. And when you talk poker and gambling, and you're right, it is a game of skill, but you've got a random deck of cards, so anything can happen.
And obviously, there are some people that are, I've played with people, Lon, and you know it. There, you play with some people that want to gamble, and they're not playing the game the same way you and I are, where we're, you know, waiting for our premium hands or things like that. They're going in there to gamble. They're going in there with, you know, a flush draw, and they're shoving all in with two cards to come, hoping they're going to get there, because they know if they do, they've got, you know, they've got the nuts. But there are people that are there to gamble.
And what, well, yeah, and that's where we're seeing, you're going to see people who have dipped their toe and maybe their entire leg in, into the training sites, and tells you what is correct to do in a certain situation. And a lot of times it is just that, which you mentioned, you know. And you will see people where it's the odds are it's appropriate to do that shove. And it does seem reckless and out of line, but they'll give you 100 reasons, you know, up the wazoo on why what they did was correct. But I don't see with the new crew of highly trained young gun robotic type players that don't talk at the table, you don't see them in the pit losing their, you know, poker paycheck on the way out like you did in the old days. There's stories of poker pros who win an event and they can't get to the parking lot without losing the chips they have, and they just won.
I'm that guy.
Yeah, yeah,
I am. I'm that guy. I would
go see that with a new player.
Lon, I'd go make $700 or $800 and, you know, a 7 or 8 hour session, and I can't get out the door without walking by a craps table and donking it all the way on a craps table.
Yeah.
I know the story. I am the story.
You are the story, right. And so you don't see that with the newer crew. What you do see, I think even I see a lot more sports betting, and that is the same thing with the gambling, is that that has become so easy to do and to satisfy that itch. I worry. I really do worry about that and the fabric of our society, where you really can't, you know, drive an hour without running across a casino. A busy casino, and they all seem to be busy, which was a great underscore. I'm not going to delve into this, but it was a great underscore that Donald Trump was able to run casinos into the freaking ground when everyone else is so successful. But I digress. Yeah, it is too easy. There are too many of them. But you know, society need money, and that's a way to get the money to keep the schools open. So, yeah, it's tough.
You mentioned Sheldon Adelson, by the way. One of his prized possessions, he recently passed away, but one of his prized possessions is right here in Singapore, Marina Bay Sands, which is one of his properties, or was one of his properties. Amazing casino here. If you ever get to Singapore, if people ever get to Singapore, they should obviously go and check it out. Talking with Lon McCarron, World Series of Poker commentator, joining us here on the Intersection podcast. Social media. It's another way the game has changed in terms of the way players interact. In terms of the way everybody interacts, but especially in terms of the way players interact. I was watching Vanessa. I was just reading online before I was talking to you. Vanessa Selps, who used to obviously be a world-class poker player.
Yesterday or today, yeah.
Yeah, and she was tweeting about, you know, playing in a tournament or something like that, and you know, but she was able to kind of step away from the game at a young age, made her money, kind of walked away and is doing who knows what now. I talked to her when she won her first like big event in Connecticut. I think it was at Mohegan or Foxwoods back in 2009 or 2010. But how has social media changed the dynamic of the game?
The game, huh?
Or at least the personalities and the way they interact, because, I mean, look, there are people that don't like each other, and they snipe at each other, and, you know, there's also...
a lot of times, anonymously, that's the worst thing about social media. I mean, I got into a little battle, you know, just last week with guys that I know, and, you know, I'm happy to
I saw
put
that.
My name to it. Yeah, a lot of people are not, but... Vanessa actually went to work on Wall Street. I don't know if she's still there, but you know, with a baby and all of that. She had a great tweet where she came back to play a tournament and she says, "Yeah, I played great, played for 6 hours, built a big stack and took a bad beat and lost all my chips. I love this game."
Yeah.
So it's tough. But social media, I think kind of like, oh gosh, not to the degree, but when I talk to players who are going to be playing on our TV table, who have never done that before, they are shocked by how much their game changes and how all the eyeballs on them factors into their decisions, and not wanting to look stupid on TV and not be disparaged by those on social media who would do just that for someone, you know, who is not playing optimally. And so and we saw it on these last shows that we had, and people are mean. People
yes,
want to have a voice, and people want to stir the pot, but without the, you know, the repercussions and without the consequences. So they've got a different screen name than their regular name.
For people who haven't been following, and shame on them if they haven't, for people who haven't been following, give me a sense for how much COVID changed the World Series of Poker this year. I know I've read up on it, but explain to our listeners how much it impacted the World Series of Poker, because it impacted it in a big way.
It really did. The World Series was not run this year in 2020. It's an event that they moved to the summer months of Vegas. Which, if you've ever been to Las Vegas in the summer, you know why nobody does anything in Vegas in the summer. But this event drew people to Las Vegas in the summer months. You know, 80,000, 90,000 people to come play in the World Series of Poker. It used to be, I mean, it was such a big footprint that until they wised up, the other casinos basically would shut down their poker rooms and say, "Oh, the World Series here, we can't do anything." That has flipped 180 degrees, where now there's probably 10 poker rooms in Las Vegas who now build their tournament schedule around the World Series of Poker. And you've got a ladies week that leads up to the ladies championship of the World Series of Poker. So if you bust out of the World Series and you're a woman, there are four other tournaments going on that day or the next day. Same thing with the seniors events and all the specialty events. So everyone's riding on the coattails of World Series of Poker, and it made Vegas in summertime. You can go far back as you want, from the people who are buying clothing at home and buying food to travel and traveling and cars and hotels and all. Like, I mean, the economy that the World Series of Poker has built in you know, basically Death Valley in the summertime is amazing. And boom, it stopped. It just didn't happen. They did a semblance of the World Series of Poker. They tried to do something online, and they got a huge field on Not the World Series site, and it was a different buy-in and different structure. And then in December, they said, "No, we have to have a world champion," and they decided to play online on their own site and a partner site in the international. And so they had an international group, and they had a U.S. site, and then all online, and they got down to the final nine, and they played a final nine live table in Czech Republic and one in Vegas. And the winners of each of those tables then met one-on-one in Vegas to play, and the winner of that became the world champion. Those are the shows that just aired yesterday, matter of fact, for the first time. So they didn't get the hotel rooms. They didn't get the people. It was just disastrous for so many people who work in the industry you know, the maintenance crews, the people who do the rooms, the people who park the cars. There's no valet parking in Las Vegas. It just destroyed it, basically. And it's going to take a long time to recover. They're very confident they will have a live event this year, but you're looking October, November, December, which would be great to be in Las Vegas, you know, during wintertime. So, sure. Things are looking good for this year, but later this year, they're not going to get the field they have. But I think once we get by 2021, 22, I think we'll be pretty close to normal.
I'm glad you mentioned women, too, because women don't get enough credit oftentimes in our society. And we often, you know, we talk about equal pay for equal work and things like that. And women in poker, and it's something you've probably had a chance to witness over the last 17 years, more women entering the game, more women being part of the game, more women being accepted and respected in the game.
No. no. I mean, you look at the percentage of women. If you look at the percentage of women in the main event, it's been pretty steady at 4% and below, right in that area.
Well, then why not?
Of course, yeah, that's huge. That is a great question. And that from what I can glean, women think male poker players are total assholes. And they don't respect them at the table on a lower level. You know, of course, you're going to get the Vanessa Selps and you know, the few others, Maria Hoes and like that, who know what they're doing. And Jamie Kershetter, my partner on these shows as well. So much respect for her. But, it's the X and Y, and it's the Venus and Mars, and they're just wired differently, and their motivation is different in general. But it's so hard to build that grassroots effort when it's that grassroots room is so difficult to break into. It's so intimidating for a woman to walk in the first time. It was intimidating for me to walk into my first poker room. And I can just imagine, you know, a woman walking in with those same trepidations of wondering how the game actually works in a live sense and having the misogynistic issues that you're going to run into, you know, hands down, it's going to happen, you know, one way or another. So it's unfortunate. We just need to shift attitudes and realize that, you know, women should really be running pretty much everything that men are involved in, and yes, it will be better.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I let you go, last one. You've done a lot in your career. World Series of Poker, you did X Games, you did bowling. Didn't you do roller derby? Did you do roller derby too?
No, you never I didn't do roller derby. Okay, okay. I watched a lot of Charlie O'Connell growing up and Joni Weston.
But I mean, you've done a lot. Yeah. I mean, inline skating.
I did inline skating for 2 years, so maybe that's where that came from.
X Games, all that. Okay.
Yeah.
Is there one thing on the bucket list that you would still like to do, that you'd still like to call, that you that, yeah, that if the opportunity, yeah, was there, you would go for? What would it be? If I give you one.
The Olympics. I never did the Olympics. And that has changed as well. Because so much of my work life and the glamour factor of the travel, I've been so many places, all 50 states and you know, most of the continents and a lot of countries and large events and stuff like that, but I always wanted to cover skiing in Austria, and I got a gig hosting World Cup skiing for 1 year on ESPN. And we were about to make the hop over to Europe, and they came in and they replaced me. This was like 90, I forget what year it was. They replaced me with Michelle Tafoya, who took my job and took it to Europe and denied me from my dream of covering skiing in Austria. But yeah, no, I always wanted to do the Olympics. I did X Games and I'm well-rounded. You know, I do a lot of different sports, and I think I could have fit in well. They talked about poker in the Olympics, and they talked about kickboxing. I did you know, martial arts, you know, for a decade or more, but never got the chance to do the Olympics. So now a lot of the stuff is done in an announce booth in New York. They don't travel, you know. They were doing COVID announcing before COVID was a thing. And so it wouldn't be the same, but it would be nice to do an Olympics. And because all our shows are post-produced, and you got to get excited about a nine on the river. So I can do curling. Come on.
Fair enough. Lon McCarron, I want to say thank you. There are a million reasons you could have said no to my request, namely starting with my being a jerk back when you got the PBA tour job. You are a gentleman and a scholar.
I'm almost over that, okay?
All right. I appreciate the time, and be well, be safe. And have you ever been to Singapore?
No.
See, you got to get here. Thailand. We got to work on that. We'll have to get you something where we get one of the casinos to bring you in here. I'll have to go talk to the powers that be here.
Oh, that'd be fun. I know there's no chewing gum in public.
That's what everybody knows. Everybody says the same thing when I say Singapore. They're like, oh, you get caned if you chew gum. So, you know what's really good about Singapore? There's no COVID. There's no COVID in Singapore. Yeah. That's the one thing about Singapore that I can tell you right from the start.
We don't hear about Singapore in that. That's, yeah. Okay, cool.
They've had country of 5.5 million people. They've had 29 deaths.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Wow. No, there's no COVID here. It's crazy. Nice. And it's because they're super strict, but there's no COVID.
Yeah. Well, Australia did a job, too.
Yeah. So, Lon, thank you so much. Seriously.
Great to see you, man. I'm glad you're well and happy, and I hope this just, you know, makes your world here with this new show.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, buddy.
And that will do it for another episode of the Intersection Podcast. Thanks again to Lon McCarron. Catch him on the World Series of Poker broadcasts. He is also on Twitter at Lon McCarron, LonMCeachern. Don't forget to catch me on Twitter too, at The Back Page. If you haven't done so yet, subscribe to the Intersection Podcast from Believe. We're on all your favorite podcasting platforms. And while you're at it, subscribe to the Up Late with Jason Page podcast. It's our 1 hour nightly show. We have it delivered to you each morning, and you'll never miss a second. Till next time, stay safe, stay grounded. I'm Jason Page. Thanks for coming through the Intersection Podcast from Believe.